From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. The events of June 6th shook the nation, but they also galvanized a movement that continues to grow in strength and influence. And woe to those who believe the wholesale undermining of our union has somehow ceased.
They were hoping, the government was hoping, that they could sort of sucker 90% of the population into getting vaccinated, and it isn't happening, right? Younger people are well aware of what the risks
are. We'll take a look at these trends as expressed from the stage of the Conservative Political Action Conference last weekend, and as fueled by far-right religious elected officials with Deseret News reporter Maya Jaradat.
There is this secular fantasy that as people move away from religion, that they'll become more rational and reasonable, but that is not happening.
Religious beliefs and convictions have a profound impact on the lives of each of us, whether religious or not. A groundbreaking new project from the Public Religion Research Institute, the Census of American Religion, has just been released, and we'll look at the highlights with PRRI CEO Dr. Robert Jones.
The denial of God, the denial of the transcendent, does great damage to the human heart.
A lot of people are absolutely certain that religious faith makes life better. While for many, that is almost certainly true, some interesting findings out of Germany suggest that it's not a necessity. We'll hear from Cologne University researcher Katarina Poles.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the global intersection of religion, culture, and politics. An alarming number of church burnings and other acts of vandalism in Canada has given ample fodder for right-wing opponents of the current government there. In truth, the attacks seem connected to ever-growing revelations of thousands of deaths of Indigenous children forcibly taken from their families and shipped off to church-run government schools come cultural assimilation centers for most of a century. Canadian Indigenous leaders are united in denouncing the destruction, saying it helps no one. A group of Catholic bishops in Spain has been ordered by the Vatican to disavow an ex-gay therapy group to which they'd been referring congregants. The Congregation of the Clergy in Rome wrote of the conversion group, ironically called Truth and Freedom, quote, "Under no circumstances is this an ecclesial association, and the Episcopal Conference has never supported or authorized it. What's more, we encourage those who consider themselves affected or victim to file a civil complaint." And it was MLK who reminded us that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. A pretty extreme example of this is playing out in the UK, where the Church of England is preparing a formal apology for anti-Semitic laws enacted at its behest in 1222. Quoth one particularly pragmatic and patient Jewish leader in Blighty, "Better late than never."
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you. Thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest. Deseret News religion reporter Maya Jaradat was with us just a few weeks ago, sharing disturbing impressions from the Faith and Freedom Coalition's gathering in Florida. Her latest article headlined, "These Christian Lawmakers Are Trying to Restore a More Godly Nation," delves into actual office holders who see America as nothing less than a theocracy, with themselves as the high priests of a government that would be anathema to the founding fathers of this nation and, for that matter, for Americans. Maya, thank you for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
As I read your article, I remembered what journalist Jeff Charlotte told me on this program well before January 6, 2021. He said, "This is no longer the fringe. This is the Republican mainstream." The truth of that statement permeates your latest Deseret article, just like it permeated the CPAC gathering last weekend. Looking at both, I see a perfect storm of theocrats and authoritarians committed to neutering our democracy itself. Do you think that I'm being overstating when I say that?
Well, I don't know about overstating, but what I find really fascinating, I was thinking about it this morning, what I find fascinating about this organization and the structure they're building, and it's funny you use the word storm, because you could think about this organization as a kind of very large ship, or at least that's what they're attempting to construct, right? Mm-hmm. By linking up lawmakers across the nation, conservative Christian lawmakers, to be precise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Across the nation. And I feel like something that's fascinating about the National Association of Christian Lawmakers to me is that in creating this structure, it kind of almost sets them outside the bounds of all this Trump, no Trump, you know, DeSantis drama, and create something that's almost more enduring and that could weather some political storms in a way that, you know, when you go to a conference like Faith and Freedom Coalition or CPAC, I mean, so much of it is just this kind of empty rhetoric. There's no real talk about policy or solutions. You know, there's nothing of real substance at these meetings, in my humble opinion. Mm-hmm. But something like the National Association of Christian Lawmakers, I mean, they're trying to make a coordinated effort, you know, to create a united national front to push through legislation. Like, they've got their nose to the grindstone, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it almost makes it impervious to some of the waves of politics. And like, they've got their eyes set on the real prize, you know, for them, which is pushing through conservative legislation that will actually make an impact on the daily lives of Americans, whether they're of faith or not.
What you say makes sense, and from my perspective, makes me more fearful.
I mean, I reckon that, you know, it's a more, I mean, in my mind, it's a more potent strategy, you know? I mean, they're flying beneath the radar to some extent of some of this media coverage. I mean, the organization is almost a year old, and I broke the story about them. So, you know, and these are not just, you know, nobody, you know, small-time politicians. Like, Dennis Baxley is a member, you know. We've got the Arkansas senator who pushed through the 2013 legislation around the heartbeat, you know, one of the first heartbeat bans.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some pretty big, you know, names involved. And I feel like that staying kind of below the radar, doing the work, you know, while other Republicans are on the stage slinging mud at each other, I mean, is actually kind of a brilliant strategy if you think about it.
I wish you would talk a little bit more about the characters that you write about and how they're organizing themselves. Who are the political religious right characters that you're talking about?
Well, we have Jason Rapert. He is the founder and the president, and Arkansas state senator. And, you know, he talks about his initial decision to run as something that he prayed on, you know, and got a divine answer. So his whole, you know, candidacy and political career has been fueled by the sense of the divine, you know, mm-hmm. being a part of his work, of his mission. There's Janet Holton, who's the big anti-abortion activist in Ohio, and she's also part of the national board. I mean, there's many different names. Mm-hmm. There's Vicky Strong, who is she feels like an embattled Christian lawmaker in Vermont. She points out that she's one of the very few Christian conservative politicians in Vermont. And she feels that this is a way for her to forge ties with Christian legislators in other states that, you know, can help her feel supported when she's out there alone in Vermont. Mm-hmm. So there's that aspect as well that Christian lawmakers want to, you know, build ties with each other so they feel supported when they're taking legislation that might be contentious, you know, into their state legislators.
Mm-hmm. Have some politicians thirsty for power found a way to get some, or are these true believers fighting for the causes they deeply believe in?
I reckon it's a bit of both, but I really think, honestly, it's more of the latter. I really feel like these people are really keen to push forward certain pieces of legislation, you know, certain laws that reflect their idea of what faith should look like. I mean, these people feel that faith, their version of Christianity, and I emphasize that it's their version because, mm-hmm. you know, when I've spoken to other Christians who are a bit more progressive and I've said, oh, these are Christian lawmakers, they correct me and they go, no, they're conservative Christian lawmakers, mm-hmm. which is a really important sure. distinction, I think, to right. make. Yeah. But they are indeed, I mean, they have a vision of what it means to be a Christian in America and what, how that should impact the public square. And the lives of people who are not even Christians, you know, which I think is something that, you know, that's a point that could easily be interrogated that, mm-hmm. you know, if I personally, I'm Jewish and, mm-hmm. You know, if I, as a Jewish person living in America, as an American Jew, I mean, should I have to live under Christian laws? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure about that. And, They talk a lot about that the founding fathers intended this to be a Christian nation, mm-hmm. but if you actually go back to a lot of the texts they refer to, you know, there is talk about God, of course, but I don't see any talk about any particular religion.
No.
Now, they are also using this language of Judeo-Christian, and I think that term needs to be interrogated as well, this kind of easy breezy lumping together of Jewish and Christian. I mean, they're distinct. Theologically, they're distinct. Some of the values that emerge from the two religions are quite distinct as well. So, I mean, that needs to be unpacked. Also, they're voicing a lot of support for Israel, and Israel is my kind of area of specialty, and that's a place I don't mind speaking about, including my personal opinion. And, you know, something that is deeply uncomfortable for me and disturbing is what conservative Christian Americans often think, you know, is support of Israel versus the reality of how many Jewish Americans see it
right.
and how many Israelis themselves see it. So, I mean, they're also supporting this, let's be specific and say a right-wing mm-hmm. agenda regarding Israel that, in my opinion, actually runs counter to Israel's best interest, you know.
Mm-hmm. The 2016 presidential election win seemed to galvanize this movement. The 2020 presidential election loss seems to have helped them even more. Is mm-hmm. this an unstoppable rising wave? Because honestly, I don't see activists defending the Constitution. Secularism, mm-hmm. pluralism, inclusivity, tolerance, and democracy itself with anywhere near the fervor that right-wing characters relentlessly display.
Mm-hmm. I think you hit on a really important point that, like, 2020 has not taken the wind out of anyone's sails. Right. In fact, I think it's kind of caused them to double down. And in fact, I mean, this organization was created ahead of the election, but I mean, they haven't disbanded in the wake of the election. And in fact, they're convening this weekend their first conference, you know, to vote on model legislation, you know, that they will then probably try to roll out in other states. So I think that, you know, 2016, you know, definitely signaled to the conservative Christian right that, like, oh, they have some momentum, and 2020 has only galvanized them. And I think, again, that one of the most fascinating parts of this story is that they are building a very kind of organized and concrete, you know, structure with this group. Mm-hmm. And that was one of their, I mean, they told me that was one of their intentions when they met for the first time last year. I mean, they very intentionally made this kind of structure, you know, with the president and then state chairs to help things run more smoothly and more efficiently so they can really get things done, and, you know, which is sharing legislation across state lines. So, you know, a bill that passes in Texas, and specifically that the heartbeat bill is the big thing that they're buzzing about right now. You know, if a bill is successful in Texas, then they can try, you know, to push it through in another state, things like this. And, you know, it's not going to be just abortion. It's not going to be just the heartbeat bill. There will be other bills. And I think that this coordinated effort, you know, to pass the language of bills across state lines, you know, so it can kind of, they can push through, you know, on state fronts is really important and shouldn't be ignored.
Let me just interject here how profoundly I resent yet another ideological mob claiming for their cult-like collection of beliefs the broad and inclusive label of Christian. What's on the horizon as you see it?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, and that's what I'm waiting to see, because their meeting kicks off today and concludes Sunday. So Friday and Saturday, they're going to be talking about exactly that, what's on the horizon for them, legislation-wise, policy-wise. I did speak with Rappert earlier this week, and he didn't really give me any hints, but we do have a phone call scheduled for Monday morning, so he can kind of debrief me on the conference.
Maya, how does this bunch dovetail with the earlier work of Project Blitz, which was dumping templated culture war legislation through the transoms of Republican-ruled state houses coast to coast?
Well, I reckon it takes up the baton, but just makes it a bit more structured, perhaps, and a bit more enduring. Mm-hmm. Again, I think that this structure of a president and state chairs, you know, and convening as a conference on an annual basis, you know, yeah, will make, you know, Project Blitz, it will make it like almost a continual Project Blitz, right? Mm-hmm. And it sets up the framework for this to be a more lasting, coordinated effort, you know, that could be taking place on an annual basis.
Let's talk about CPAC. What stood out for you at this gathering of leading right-wing figures?
You know, I was interested in the lineup and who wasn't there, right? So I see that Trump was there and DeSantis was not, and I find that fascinating. At the same time, I was really interested that, you know, DeSantis came out ahead in that straw poll that did not include Trump. So he came out strong in the straw poll that included Trump. But then when they eliminated Trump, like, he came out, he like easily, you know, went to the front of the pack as the possible leader for 2024. So that's one of the things that I found really, really interesting. And it was something that I picked up on at Faith and Freedom. There was no straw poll, but DeSantis was on everyone's mind, you know, that if Trump doesn't run, they love DeSantis. So I thought that was interesting. And again, you know, I've been thinking about the National Association of Christian Lawmakers in respect to CPAC, and that's the thing. I mean, CPAC, you know, I was watching some of the speeches. It feels like a lot of the same stuff I heard at Faith and Freedom Coalition, like Marxism is bad, Democrats are socialists and Marxists. Again, it's that kind of empty rhetoric that's intended to whip up the audience, but doesn't really offer any solutions or policies.
Were there many religious voices in Dallas?
There were. But I feel like, you know, it's nothing distinct from what we've seen at Faith and Freedom, you know, and elsewhere.
What else do you want people to be watching for as we head into the traditionally less political summer months?
That's a really good question. I think just, you know, how groups like the National Association of Christian Lawmakers, how these groups are kind of quietly maybe coalescing, and what they're looking ahead at, you know, might be an important thing for the rest of us to keep our eyes on as well.
Maya Jaradat is religion reporter at Deseret News and the author of the book, The Unchosen, The Lives of Israel's New Others. We'll link to her article, These Christian Lawmakers Are Trying to Restore a More Godly Nation. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Okay, thanks for having me.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, the Public Religion Research Institute's new Census of American Religion. And later, a look at whether religious faith makes us happier. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. It is no overstatement that most of the turmoil and tribulation roiling our nation today is either driven by or reflected in religious differences. It's not something I would have seen coming without the help of the Public Religion Research Institute, which has been doing invaluable work researching the expression and impact of faith in and on our society and culture since 2009. Now, an ambitious new publication from PRRI helps us get an unprecedented big picture view. It's called The Census of American Religion, and I'm happy that it brings Institute founding CEO Dr. Robert P. Jones back to State of Belief Radio. Robbie, thank you for being with us again.
Thanks, Welton. That's always really fun to be back and looking forward to the conversation.
So, what were the origins of the census?
Yeah, well, I'll start with the word census. Beginning in the late 1950s, the U.S. Census Bureau stopped collecting religion data, really around concerns about separation of church and state issues. So we don't have in any of the official U.S. Census data any data on religion. We at PRRI have kind of stepped into the void here, and we began working on this actually 7 years ago. So this report is literally 7 years in the making. We have interviewed over 500,000 Americans over the last 7 years to kind of get this report that goes all the way down to the county level. And that's what's really new here is that, you know, we've had national numbers, we've had regional numbers, and since 2014, we at PRRI have even had state level data, but we've never had county level that's this rigorous and that can really tell us, something down at such a granular level.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's remarkable that you continue to find the starkest distinctions not along denominational lines, but rather along lines of race among Christians. This feels to me like a completely under-recognized truth in modern-day America.
You know, I think that's right. I think it's I think we're making a dent in there. We had a you know, major hit this week with Philip Bump at the Washington Post, and the title of it was using this county level data, which he then correlated to the county level vote data, and the headline was, if you want to know how your county voted in the last election, all you need to know is how many white Christians there were. And the reason for that is that the correlation between white Christian identity and vote is very, very strong. So you can predict vote with a fair amount of accuracy just by knowing that one trait about someone. And in fact, you know, this has been true increasingly so since the 1980s. And that's really the beginning of when you know, we had white evangelicals and other white Christians actually move from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party with that Reagan election. And since then, you know, if you look at the religious landscape in voting, it's essentially been true in virtually every election since Reagan to say that, you know, if you want to know how religious Americans vote, you can sum it up in two sentences. White Christians tend to vote in majorities for Republican candidates, and pretty much everybody else in the country tends to vote majority for Democratic presidential candidates. And you can still see that, and it's becoming more and more pronounced. So when you look, for example, at a county, we have more than a dozen really cool heat maps on the website that you can look at all the way down the county level. And when you look at the one that is white Christian identity by county, and you put it right next to the presidential vote by county, I mean, they look really, really similar.
The census made plenty of headlines around the key finding that long-term trends seem to be stabilizing, both in the decline of white Christians and what had long seemed to be the relentless growth in unaffiliated Americans. Talk about those findings, if you would.
Sure. You know, I think prior to, you know, really this report, you know, if you and I had been doing this interview, and we've actually done this a couple of times, you know, the headlines have been pretty steady. More unaffiliated people, fewer white Christians in the country across the board. And that was across all white Christian subgroups. And now actually it's a little more complex than that. So so this year we have some stabilization and even one notable kind of reversal of a trend. So, you know, what we basically see is the numbers stabilizing of unaffiliated Americans. So, you know, that trend has been really remarkable. If we go back to the 1990s, only single digits, like 5-6% of Americans considered themselves religiously unaffiliated. And that number today is 23%. It hit a high of 25 a couple of years ago, has now settled back a couple of points, but kind of settling in at just under a quarter of Americans today. So it's quadrupled since the 1990s. And then we had this kind of slide of all kind of white Christian groups. And in the last 10 years, the most notable one has been the decline of white evangelical Protestants. Now that's going to be a little surprising, perhaps given how much ink is still spilled and how much influence they still have in politics. But, you know, if we go back to 2008, they were 21% of the population. Our latest data has them down under 15%, 14.5% of the general population. White Catholics have been in decline as well, but they've stabilized around 12% of the population now. The real surprise is an uptick, a kind of reversal of a decades-long trend among white non-evangelical Protestants, you know, often called the mainline Protestants. These are people who are white and Protestant and Christian, but do not consider themselves to be evangelical or born again. And they kind of hit a low point of 13% around 2015 and have basically been stable right there. And then the last couple of years, they have ticked up and are now 16%. And what's notable is that as they've ticked up, their median age have gone down. So it means that they have actually ticked up and have picked up young people on the way, which is something that really every religious group has been struggling to do.
A surprise for me this time was what's happened to the nuns. Is this the first time the nuns have not projected a major group of people?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, really, like I said, this is a trend that's been going on since the 90s. There's been this kind of steady uptick in the number of religiously unaffiliated people in America. And we, you know, at least the data we have right now shows that there was really this peak in 2017, 2018, where they reached a quarter of the population. There's been a slight settling back and plateauing down to 23%. So it seems like, you know, we may have found, at least for the time being, kind of a little plateau in that growth. And, you know, that's not so unusual with trends that have accelerated that long. They tend to find kind of a plateau. One clue, though, that it may not be the final, you know, the final number is that we still are showing, you know, such a dramatic age difference. So if we look at Americans under the age of 30 today, you know, we're still at, they're 36% unaffiliated, right? So that's still well above that number. And this cohort of young people is significantly more unaffiliated than young people were, say, in 2006, 1996, or 1986. So if we go back to 1986, for example, and look at young people and younger Americans under the age of 30 in 1986, only 1 in 10 were unaffiliated, and it's 36% today. So nearly four times as many young people today are unaffiliated than they were in 1986. That tells me, you know, we still may be in for those numbers to tick up even a little more, even if we found kind of a temporary plateau here.
Were there any other surprises for you in the results of this research this time?
Well, you know, I think one that we had seen before, but it just continues to astound me every time I see it, you know, in a chart, is how the political parties continue to sort themselves along the lines of race and religion. And we really do have now a kind of ethno-religious partisan sort. And what I mean by that is just this, I just can't overstate how dramatic, you know, the kind of white Christian cohesion around Republican identity has become. So today, for example, the Republican Party is about 2/3 white and Christian. The Democratic Party is, you know, just under 40% white and Christian. And if you, we have a really interesting chart that we basically overlay the racial and religious composition of the two political parties onto the generational strata. And when you do that, I mean, the result is basically this. You don't really need to see it to get it. That when we compare the two political parties, the Democratic Party looks about like 30-year-old America does in terms of race and religion. And the Republican Party today looks about like 70-year-old America in terms of its racial. And so when we hear things like make America great again, right, and I think it's a little clue to why that nostalgic, backward-looking again part of that slogan has been so powerful to this group that is aging and shrinking and looking kind of wistfully back at a time when they were more dominant part of the country.
You know, no matter what anyone wants to believe, demographics continue to be destiny. There are changes in the numbers for non-Christian groups in this research. What can those be attributed to the most, population shifts or people converting?
Yeah, you know, the numbers for non-Christian Americans, it's interesting, are still remain, you know, fairly small. You know, the country, it is absolutely diversifying. It's diversifying faster in terms of race and ethnicity than it is in terms of religion. Non-Christian religious groups make up about 5%. Of the country today. That's been relatively stable over the last, you know, 10 years or so. We are seeing, though, Jewish Americans getting younger. So there's some, for example, that's really notable that group is kind of holding on to younger people, which bodes, you know, was a small group, but it bodes bodes well for the future. And other groups, you know, are also reliant on immigration patterns. And so, you know, we saw this kind of explosion after the 1960s with kind of new immigration policy that opened up the doors to particularly non-European immigration in the mid 1960s, and we're seeing the results of that now. So you know, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But the one bigger thing I could say is that on this front is that you really can see a lot of American history, cultural history, in the pattern, these county level patterns, you know, where you see, for example, Hindus, Buddhists, kind of non-Western religious traditions, you know, showing up really on the West Coast in California. You can see those, and you can see Catholics still with a kind of, you know, turn of the 20th century influx of immigration that brought a lot of Catholic Americans here through Ellis Island. You can still see that kind of cluster in the Northeast. It's kind of remarkable, I think, that and you can still see the Civil War split between you know, evangelicals and non-evangelical white Christians. You know, these things are still, these realities are still very much with us, not just in our politics, but you know, but in our religious traditions. Mm-hmm.
Robbie, you've been doing a bunch of interviews since the release of the American Religious Census. What are interviewers like me missing? What are we not asking that you would really want to answer and need to answer?
Well, I think that one of the things that the county level data helps us see is that, like, a lot of times we, because the data that we have has mostly been national data, right, that we talked about these big national trends. But I think it's really important that we see how this how these trends are going all the way down, you know, to the ground level. So there's virtually no place in the country that is completely exempt from these transformations that are happening in the country. And I take my home state of Mississippi, you know, as a good example here that, you know, even a state like Mississippi, which is known for being, you know, overwhelmingly religious, 15% of the state, you know, is religiously unaffiliated today. And even in Mississippi, white evangelicals only make up 21% of the state. Now, you know, very similar story like in Texas. In fact, in Texas today, the unaffiliated are actually larger than any other religious group in the state. It's another state known for kind of evangelical politics. White evangelicals make up 14% of Texans, but the religiously unaffiliated make up 20%. Yeah. And I think our realities haven't really, our understanding of this reality we haven't really caught up to these realities on the ground. Hmm.
This week, your incredibly timely book, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, was released in paperback and ranks number one on the Amazon Hot New Releases chart for religion and spirituality. In the past year, we've seen some denominations step up to confront their historical complicity mm-hmm. in American racism. Does that encourage you?
That's a great question. You know, I have to say, when I turned in the book manuscript at the end of 2019, you know, and then the book came, the hardcover came out in 2020. The paperback is out this week. And the paperback has a new afterword in it reflecting on the election and the insurrection on January 6th and how that connects to the research on white supremacy in Christianity. But, you know, so when the book was kind of the bulk of the book was wrapped, none of the events in 2020, the removal of Confederate monuments, the protests for racial justice across the country, none of that had happened. And, you know, I'd say that I am more encouraged that what we're seeing is many. I've also spoken to I actually counted it up the other day, more than 70 local groups in the past year. Mm. And I just would not have expected that much. And most of those were congregations, you know, and most of them were white congregations that were really trying to wrestle with this legacy, this history that's been so suppressed and the ways that they were not only silent but complicit in upholding white supremacy in their own histories.
I'm going to assume that you agree that far too few are owning up to that responsibility so far. How will we know that the message has gotten through to leaders and congregations? And this actually brings us full circle where today's conversation began, which is the profound division between how Christians of different races see themselves and each other as documented in the American religious census.
You know, I think one of the things we would see and is a closing of this enormous chasm between African-American Protestants, by the way, you know, more than a third of whom consider themselves evangelical, you know, and white evangelical Protestants. It is, you know, more than 100 years ago, it was 100 years ago last year, actually, that H. Richard Niebuhr wrote this scathing critique of American churches called The Social Sources of Denominationalism. And he, one of the things he pointed to was this enormous, you know, what he called a kind of heretical color line, as is the word that he used, in the church, that white and black congregations were essentially separated, right? And you, and there's just this legacy of slavery and discrimination, you know, written into the churches today. Churches continue to be largely segregated as a result of that history. But I think one thing we'd be able to measure quite easily is that, you know, the voting gap, right? That and I think we saw it more pronounced with President Trump, that more than 9 in 10 African-American Protestants voted Democrat, voted for Biden in the last election, and 84% of white evangelicals voted for Trump, a candidate who was leading, you know, the charge on things like denying or denouncing, you know, so-called critical race theory, criticizing Colin Kaepernick for taking a knee during to protest the treatment of African-American, killing of African-Americans by police, who, you know, all kinds of ways expressed just explicitly racist attitudes and support for white supremacist groups, right? And that didn't put a dent in the white evangelical support. In fact, they supported him more in 2020 than they did in 2016. You know, I think that ought to be horrifying for every white Christian in America, that and there ought to be at least enough humility, I think, among white Christians to think, like, what are we missing and what do we have wrong that 9 in 10, you know, African-American Christians, our black and brown brothers and sisters in this country, see politics so differently than we do, and what's that about, and what might we need to learn and reexamine in our own hearts and souls? I think we'd, you know, real evidence, we'd see this white and black Christian voting gap close.
Yeah. Dr. Robert P. Jones is the founding CEO of the Independent Public Religion Research Institute, which has just released the 2020 Census of American Religion. He's the author of two important books, The End of White Christian America and White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, which appeared this week in paperback form. Perfect for some reading on the beach. If you're not going to the beach, you still need to read it. Robbie, you know, I guess I do this every time when I look at what you are doing in our nation. And then I think of that first day that you walked in my office and said, I'm coming here. I want to be here. And you didn't even have a knowledge of what was going to happen. It has happened, brother. And it's happened for you and it's happened for all of us. And I thank you. And I also thank you for all of these times to come to State of Belief Radio and let our listeners benefit from what you're doing also. Thank you, man.
Oh, thanks, Welton. That's so kind of you. And let me just kind of shout back to you for all the decades of work blazing a trail, you know, that so many of us have benefited from. So thank you.
Thank you, man. The Daily Mail UK headline was blunt. Religion isn't the secret to happiness. Global study claims atheists are just as happy as those with a faith. The findings of these researchers at the University of Cologne in Germany didn't make the news on this side of the Atlantic, but they certainly seem worth taking a look at. And so I am happy to have reached lead researcher Dr. Katarina Poles to get some details on the study. Katarina, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm curious, what got you interested in this question of life satisfaction in the first place?
Well, I think I've for a long time been interested in topics as religiosity, non-religiosity, and life satisfaction. And what then led me to a more specific research question was that I realized over the last decades, there has been a lot of research, especially in sociology, on the process of secularization. And also in psychology about the well-being and mental health of religious individuals. But there's not much known about non-religious individuals. So, it really has been researched more as developments in society, people leaving religions and, we don't know much about non-religious individuals and, that's where I thought there's a lot of interesting findings waiting. And right now in the whole world, there's really a high percentage of non-religious individuals. So it would be interesting to know more about them and their well-being and whether there really is, whether they are defined by a lack in well-being compared to religious individuals.
How did you define life satisfaction?
Well, life satisfaction is one aspect of subjective well-being, and it is a more, let's say, overall, more cognitive evaluation of how a person rates the satisfaction with life in total. So it is very widely used in as well big international surveys, and has been shown to be of value in researching personal well-being.
What countries and groups are represented?
Well, we use data from a big international, across national longitudinal survey, the World Values Survey. That is data from a lot of different countries, which is available to researchers worldwide. We took the data from Wave 6. This is from the years 2010 and 2014. And we had to exclude a few countries based on missing values on the questions that were relevant to us. And in the end, our sample consisted of 24 countries worldwide. In general, really a mix from all regions of the world. But there were very few African or Arabian countries, due to there being problems with some answers to the relevant questions missing. So it is a little bit more, let's say, on the side of Christian cultures, also some Eastern religion cultures. But it isn't just focusing on Europe or North America, as many other studies are. There is a variety of countries and religious cultures in those 24.
So what were the key findings of the research?
We first of all, we differentiated between the groups more detailed and more finely than a lot of other research has done before. So we had two types of religiosity, highly religious and weakly religious individuals, and two types of non-religiosity, non-religious individuals, and specifically atheist individuals. And that already gave us a more differentiated picture than empirical studies who combine weakly religious individuals with non-religious individuals or indifferent individuals. And then, like I said, we used this more complex statistical analysis to look at the same time at the individual relationship between life satisfaction and religiosity and non-religiosity, and to look for factors on the country level that had an influence on this individual level relationship, so interaction effects. Mm-hmm. And we found, first of all, that there is no general relation between religiosity and higher life satisfaction. We do find that this relationship exists in some countries and not in others. But wherever there is a difference between highly religious and non-religious or atheist individuals, this was dependent on country characteristics. Mm-hmm. So that means we looked at the country characteristics, the share of religious individuals in a country, which describes how religious a country is on average, and the societal level of development, that is the standard of living, health, and education. So when we included those factors in our statistical analysis, that explained the differences. And statistically speaking, they disappeared because of that, which means we describe here a person context situation, so that the relationship is dependent on the societal context. And when you look at those factors, then the differences disappear. And this is what then was reduced to the headline of that atheist individuals are just as satisfied with life as religious individuals. That isn't exactly the case. It's more that when differences appear, they are dependent on the fit to the country characteristics. What remains, though, and that was also a finding that's different from previous studies, is that even when controlling for those factors, weakly religious individuals are less satisfied with life than highly religious individuals. So this difference does not disappear when we look at the fit of the individual to the context. That seems to be a more permanent situation that is maybe more related to the actual belief, the strength of belief, or another factor that's directly related to the individual level and differences between weakly and highly religious individuals.
So with that, in that instance, does that tell us something about the need for strong beliefs above and beyond the actual beliefs themselves?
This is a first step into research on this topic, but it hints at that the strength of belief or the strength of non-belief or as well the certainty of belief or non-belief is related to subjective well-being, in this case, life satisfaction, and not so much the specific content of what you believe or don't believe in. It might really be that simply based on highly religious individuals believing more strongly in something than weakly religious individuals, that gives them an advantage in well-being.
I see. In your findings, what surprised you most, or did anything?
The majority of countries worldwide would rather be described as religious. So even though we expected, or our hypotheses were, of course, directed at finding country-level factors that explain differences, it still is quite a surprising thing to see that even when involving countries worldwide, those two country-level characteristics really explain those differences that have been found by such a big amount of previous research. And it was quite clearly that the difference only remained between strongly and weakly religious individuals.
What do you want to do with the data that you have? And I know there's more research to come, but what do you want to do with what you're learning?
My main intention maybe is to paint a more complex picture of how something like a worldview, a religiosity or something like that is connected to personal well-being, that it's too simple to focus on which group is happiest or which group is connected to most advantages, that those relations are a lot more complex. And yes, of course, it takes effort to not reduce a topic and to a simple slogan. And we probably all have an interest in reducing complexity and finding, let's say, a winner who does it best, who has the best life or something like that. And that's not how it works. It probably isn't that simple that one thing like as high religiosity is beneficial for every individual. The situation is a lot more complex. It depends on the person, the characteristics of the person, the context the person lives in, the culture a person lives in. And I think it's important to highlight all of those aspects as being important.
The research challenging the longstanding belief that religious people tend to be happier people is now the doctoral dissertation that she has finished and is now Dr. Katharina Poles at the University of Cologne in Germany. Katharina, I thank you so much for taking this time to be with us on State of Belief Radio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.